Hello and welcome to season one, episode one of the Future Urbanism podcast, hosted by myself, Neil Slotnick, aka Future Urbanism. Track in the background, the intro track, is called UVB 76 by a producer called Niccolo Machiavelli, aka Jark. We're starting with a lot of AKAs today. If you listen to the trailer for the podcast, what I said was this is just going to be an organic thing. It's got no real beginning, no real end. It's going to be random. I'm just really going to talk about things that are kind of important in my life and interesting in my life. And, you know, hopefully as we can build this up, we're going to be getting guests on. I've got a little hit list of people that I want to talk to. Some of them will be about music, some about music production, a couple of comedians. What else? A bit of kind of politics, a bit of conflict, international conflict. That's the plan anyway. Just to kind of start things off, this is my first kind of ever podcast that I've done myself. I was a guest on a podcast last week, which has really given me the bug, called The Fantastival, hosted by Stephen Nussbaum, who's also the co-host of Orient Outlook, your go-to place for information on Leighton Orient. So I just want to say, you know, huge respect to him for having me on to his podcast and for letting me pick my five acts to go into my Fantastival. Again, if you want to listen to that, it's available on Spotify, it's available on Anchor and on Apple. So if you just Google the Fantastival podcast, it will come up for you. Okay, so season one, episode one, and I was thinking, how do I make a big statement? You know, what might the listeners or, you know, whoever's listening to this want to know about? And then I'm thinking about what I find interesting. And as I said on the trailer, you know, I'm sure that there's going to be some episodes really just people, me, guests geeking out on music production, on their favourite comedians. But I'm going to start off a bit niche and a bit random, and I've been advised against this. But I think that I can do this a bit of justice, and I think this is an interesting topic to be considering. So what I want to do today is I want to talk to you, the listener, about numbers stations. And this is where everyone turns off, okay? So take yourself back to the 1980s, all right? So I was born in 1979, late 1979. I had, how many days did I have in 1979? I had 2 days in 1979. They were great times out in a hospital out in Epping. But as I was growing up, you know, I was a geeky kid. And, you know, I'm not going to get too self-indulgent. I'm rubbish at football, as I said to Steve on the Fantastival. I liked sport, but I was never particularly good at any of it. And when I got into kind of the ZX Spectrum 48K computer, that was when the geek came out. And in order for the Spectrum to work, what you needed was a radio with a cassette player, because games in them days came on tapes, as I'm sure some of you, many of you know the joy and the pain of loading up a cassette, loading up a game for 10 minutes and the thing crashing halfway through. But what I would also do, the radio had like one of those dials. You could dial up and down the wave bands. And I don't think it was FM on it. I think it was just medium wave, AM, and then you had shortwave. And as a kid, you know, I remember you could go on shortwave. And because of the technology at the time, you could tune into someone's phone call. If the next door neighbor was making a phone call, you could listen to it. I remember listening to my mum on her phone once. Yeah, exciting stuff. And it was, yeah, it was that shortwave that really got to me, because you could at any time during the day just go through that shortwave band and you would be hearing pips, cracks, pops, buzzers. You'd have numbers, letters, words, you'd have music, all sounded computerized, all sounded mechanical, sounded like the future, with loads of static in the background. And I thought nothing of it. I just used to sit there listening to it. And, you know, my dad would come up, "What are you listening to?" And it'd be something going 1, 7, 9, 5, 3. And I couldn't really explain why I listened to it. And obviously, as I got a bit older, I kind of lost interest in shortwave radio. I graduated from the Spectrum to the Amiga, so I didn't need that radio anymore. We got rid of that, or it probably broke down. But it was only recently, a couple of years ago, I just read an article on the BBC, and it was about number stations, and, you know, the fact that they're still around and they're still alive. So let's get into it then, and let's explore the general history of number stations. And I'm just going to talk to you about two that I find particularly interesting and some of the background behind them. So what is a number station? You got an author called Lewis Bush. He's written Shadows of the State, which is a history of number stations. He says number stations are unidentified radio broadcasts that consists of mechanical voices reading out strings of seemingly random numbers. Sometimes they're accompanied by music, by tones or other sound effects. But what gets me about all this is they're usually related back to kind of, I don't know, whatever you want to call it, conflict, conspiracy. It gets quite deep. There's some stations broadcasting Morse code, digital pips. They're not that interesting for me. I kind of like the real analog sounds, the static and the voices. Number stations came about during the First World War. I've got a little bit to say about that in a minute. They reached their peak during the Cold War. So if you've done GC history, you know about the Cold War. And they were just brilliant at communicating. And they could communicate whatever, okay? Now, obviously, during the Cold War, there was no real usable internet. I'm sure that different countries' governments had their ways of communicating, but there was nothing like we've got now for the younger listeners. And because this was all on shortwave, you could locate the transmitter. You could locate the transmission site. It could be an aerial. Who knows what it is? And I've got another couple of theories on that in a bit. But, and you know, you might think if you're into kind of spies and conspiracy, well, hang on, what's the point in having a spying device where people can actually tell where it is? But that wasn't really the issue. The source of the location was the source of the location. You know, it could be in a field in Kent, whatever. But what people could never figure out was who was actually picking up these messages. Anybody with a shortwave radio could get these messages. I was getting them in a little house in Redbridge in the 80s, okay? Obviously, for me, it was something to listen to and to annoy my dad and my mum. But if there was somebody with a codec, a spy sitting on a park bench in Hyde Park, they could be listening on this shortwave radio. And yeah, they could be decoding the 1, the 7, the 3, and the pip, pip, pip. And maybe they were being told something by the Stasi, by the KGB. Who knows? Who knows? And it's thought that these stations were broadcasting these calls to spies all over the world. And the Brits got on it, okay? And there's, I think, what was it? Lewis Bush in his book says, if you can't beat them, join them. One thing that Lewis Bush noted was that it's very difficult to generate a totally random number set, because if you're a human, you know, how random can you be? You will end up becoming predictable as the days goes on. So what the MI6 did in London, they found a really good solution using technology back in the day. They'd hang a microphone out of a window on Oxford Street and they'd record traffic. And what is said by Lewis Bush is that, you know, when they're recording, you might have a bus beeping and a policeman shouting, and that's a totally unique sound. It will never happen again in that same way. You might have another recording with a bus beeping and a policeman shouting, but the time scales will be different, the frequencies, the tones. And what they then do, they take this sound, they convert it into a random code using some kind of computer wizardry that's far more than I know about, and there you go, then you get your broadcasts, okay? So where can we go from there? I mean, shortwave radio, total secrecy insofar as, I can listen to it, you can listen to it. But the secrecy comes from, as said, the fact that, who knows what the recipient, who the recipient is. Is it one person and what they're doing with it? And, you know, there's plenty of military bases. We'll talk about that in a bit. It could be a random room in a Ukrainian forest. They may be manned. They may not be manned. It might just be something on repeat. And there we go. And for all of this to work, what we have is the kind of spy's best friend, your one-time pad encryption, your codec, okay? And what that will be able to do, this is kind of a paper pad. It allows the recipient to decode the message just once, and then it is thrown away. So the cipher is totally unbreakable. And because of that, we have number stations today, all right? And I'll give you some links to get some information about what's happening today.
Okno, okno,
I think that the key thing to notice is that so far we're going on supposition and conspiracy theory, but there have been a number of cases where spies have been uncovered or arrested. And what they were doing, they were caught in the act of listening to one of these number stations and using a codec. There are also some declassified documents, probably from the Cold War, where governments have openly admitted owning these number stations. So, you know, that to me comes maybe away from conspiracy. And, you know, when we're talking about 1980s, the West Soviet bloc, the kind of the real tit for tat, trying to get one up on each other. And, you know, these methods of communicating were giving, you know, these governments almost their, and I'm a teacher of economics and business, almost gave them their competitive advantage. Okay. Now, before we go in to the kind of three case studies, the three kind of key examples I'm going to talk through today, just some places to get some information on number stations if this podcast takes your interest. So you've got www.hfunderground.com/board, and that is a global forum, like them old school early 2000 forums of samples, news, conspiracy, where to tune in. www.priom.org, a huge resource, and that's along with www.numbers-stations.com. And again, just loads of information on current broadcasts, wavelengths, digital feeds. I mean, yeah, really, that's what you need. On archive.org, you've got the Connet project. If you just Google Connet, C-O-N-E-T project, you know, I think that I might be wrong on this, but I think the Connet project was the originator in kind of investigating number stations from kind of a journalistic perspective. And they've got a 5-CD bundle of just these number stations. But also, you know, it's on archive.org. It's all free access as well. So, I mean, if you've got the bug, any given night, you can just go to any of those websites, get a shortwave radio, and you might be hearing a broadcast meant for someone from the CIA, a Russian spy, a Mossad agent, somebody from MI6. To me, and I'm really into kind of Russia and your kind of social modernism and your communist times. That's my point in history, other than Northern Ireland, that I find a particular interest. And to me, Russian stations and what the Russians do with communication and numbers has really got its own kind of allure. You know, there's crazy history of an attempted coup way back when, and Moscow just pushed out a signal, and it just broadcast the number 5 for hour after hour after hour. No one knows why. It's never been said, but you imagine tuning in and you're just hearing the number 5, and that's it. Now, if you listen to my Fantastival, my location was underneath the Duga radar. And I want to talk first of all about the Duga radar. Now, this isn't specifically kind of a number station, but it does use that same kind of repetitive technology. So the Duga radar was a Soviet era radar system. And it was actually part of the Soviet Missile Defense Early Warning Radar Network. It went from 1976 July and it finished in December 1989. There were actually two Duga radars, one near one of my favorite places in the world. I quite like dark tourism, Chernobyl. And the other one is in Chernihiv in Ukraine. So that's present day Ukraine. There you go. So these Duga radars, and again, Google them, take a look. You know, they look like, as I said, like 12 massive pylons tied up together with wire. And then you have these red lights coming on ominously at night. But they were massively powerful. They broadcast to over 10 megawatts in some cases. And again, they broadcast a shortwave, which is why I'm putting them in on a numbers station podcast. They came up with no warning. And they sounded like a sharp, repetitive tapping noise with that 10 hertz repetition. And the enthusiasts, and there are a lot of enthusiasts around number stations, they called this the Russian woodpecker. Quite often what there were suggestions that this noise, this kind of repetitive noise, was used to broadcast legitimate radio broadcasts, amateur radio operations that maybe were kind of dissenting against the government. And they also were there to kind of block oceanic commercial communication. communications and utility transmission. So loads of companies were complaining about that. The second number station I want to talk about is simply called EO3. The nickname that was given to it was the Lincolnshire Pulchar. Now, again, if you're into your number stations, this is kind of the big English one. It's been inactive since 2008. In terms of what it sounded like, it was kind of a computerized woman's voice. She sounded pretty cheery. And what would happen is that when reading out numbers, the last two numbers in every given group, there will be an upward inflection. So, you know, she had a bit of a human feel to her voice. Was this really good computer technology for the time, or is that evidence kind of human involvement? It's unequivocal that it operated, it was operated by the UK government, but it was actually transmitted from a military base in Cyprus. EO3 kicked off in the 1970s. It had a kind of an older guise. It used to use a male voice. There was non-electronic music. And it came from Buckinghamshire in England, from Her Majesty's Government Communications Centre in Gorka. And it was then, and I'm not too sure when this happened, it was then tweaked to the kind of female voice. There seems to be no real kind of timing or years of when that is. But yeah, it was the female voice with the Lincolnshire Pulchar, and it came from that military base in Cyprus. It would kick off at the start of every hour, and you would get the English folk tune, the Lincolnshire Pulchar, playing in kind of digital tones. And then the woman that would start talking would identify who the message was for with a 5-digit call up. So that was kind of the introduction, and then there will be 3 chimes, and then there will be 200 groups of messages. Each transmission lasted for 45 minutes. So, you know, it sounds mad even thinking about this, how somebody will just sit there with a codec and know that it was them because of the 5-digit call up wherever they were in the world, and then be able to decipher this stuff. Yeah, crazy stuff. The voice is what makes it so popular. Around that time, quite often, you know, if you think about some of these phone calls that you get with robotized voices these days, or when you phone up a call center and you know that you're talking to some kind of AI, the initial transmissions were far more just like old computer equipment reading out numbers. But as I said, it was this Lincolnshire Pulchar that had that kind of human sound. That has enthusiast excited. Transmissions were pushed out on 3 different frequencies, and this was because the Iranians were jamming the Lincolnshire Pulchar. There was a huge amount of jamming going on, so Russia would put out a number station, the Americans would block it, the Cubans would put one out, the French might get involved. The EO3 transmissions died out in 2008. It had a sister station, EO3A, and that died out a year later. And the last log of EO3 activity was on July the 3rd of 2008. Our final focus for today is probably my second favourite number station. It's called the Buzzer, and you don't really have to put much guesswork into what it sounds like. There's a little bit of background on this. It was kind of sighted in a collection of radio towers, and it's in a Russian swampland not far from the city of St. Petersburg. It's gated, all right, and it's obviously rusted, it's rotten. There's loads of power lines, dry stone walls. It's sinister. It's really sinister. Again, Google it. You can get some nice kind of urbex pictures. The radio station, the Buzzer, was called MDZHB, and nobody has claimed to run it. Now, my assumption is it's based on Russian territory. It's probably Russian, but they've never claimed it. And for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, it just broadcasted a dull, monotonous tone. Every few seconds, a second sound came in, like some kind of foghorn. Then the drone continues. Once or twice a week, a man or woman read out some words in Russian. The general consensus was words like dinghy and farming specialists. with a used word. And the shortwave frequency was 4625 kilohertz. Today, the station's got a huge following, tens of thousands. They call it the buzzer, and it joins up with the pip and the squeaky wheel amongst the kind of fan favourites here. But I don't think any fan really knows what it is. And David Stupples, who deals in signals intelligence at City University London, says that there is absolutely no information in that signal at all. The station started broadcasting in the mid-70s, and there were two buzzers at the top of each hour, 24 hours a day. In daylight hours, this was Russian daylight hours, these little buzzes were then followed by a series of just tones, and there were 21 to 34 per minute. What you would often have, a Russian malvoice said, would read then strings of numbers, random words, sometimes even names, and what one of the good ones was Anna, Nikolai, Ivan, Tatanya, Roman. There's some Morse code in there as well. This continued for years until June 2010, when it stopped for one day. There was another interruption in August, and then it went a bit mad, okay? So the sounds it started to generate, the pips, the tones were still coming through, but there was music, there was Swan Lake from Tchaikovsky. And in September, the radio renamed itself to the MDZHB, but a malvoice after the renaming declared Mikhail Dmitry Zhenya Boris. And there we go. And I think where I'm going to finish with this, it's often kind of speculated that the buzzer is a dead hand signal. If Russia was ever wiped out in a nuclear attack, and obviously this, you know, Cold War was popping off at that point, the drone would stop, and that would be for Russia's allies to launch their retaliatory strike. There are some theories that the buzzer is still in existence, and even Vladimir Putin pointed out himself, nobody would survive a nuclear war between Russia and the United States. Could the buzzer be warding off a nuclear war? So there's my three. You've got the buzzer, you've got the Lincolnshire Pulcher, and you've got that kind of mad, the kind of Duga frequencies, those 10 megawatt frequencies. I think for today, that is as far as I can go on number stations. I could make a 3-hour long podcast looking at some of the more crazy conspiracy theories, talking to you about more. But I think really, as kind of as an episode one, that's a nice little whistle stop tour of numbers stations. As said, I gave some web links at the start. I'll put them in the show notes as well. Go and take a look. It's some interesting stuff. So I will be back next week where we will be discussing something just as scientific as number stations, but maybe a bit less niche. Have a great week. Stay safe, people.